Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Tuesday, everyone, and welcome to Ask Dr. Goodman Show. This is Melissa Biliard, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 or our toll-free number 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1, we'll cue you into the show. Tonight we have a very special lineup. We have a special show with two of Dr. Goodman's incredible best friends who are working directly with homeless community in Washington State. As many of you know, Huntington's disease sufferers sometimes end up in homeless situations, my family included. And well, tonight we're going to meet Reverend Jim Bridges, who does amazing work to help the homeless. And we also get to hear back from our super incredible Elizabeth Venezuela. She was with us a year and a half ago. I can't believe it's been that long. You may remember when she was on the show, and she was talking about how she found a man, his name was Dale, struggling with HD and living in a very sad way, in very sad conditions. And so we're going to talk about the homeless tonight and how we can help them. And welcome to the show, Reverend Jim, Elizabeth, and Dr. Goodman's in the background. Hello, everybody. How are you tonight?
It's my pleasure. Very just good. Great.
Thank you for welcoming us.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. Okay, so Jim, tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to, you know, working with the homeless community.
Okay, well, with the homeless community, I think my first exposure to the whole idea of not having a home, aside from reading about it, happened when I was working as a school psychologist in a small rural town in New York. And I was dumbfounded to discover we had several children in the elementary school who were living with their parents in a hearse.
Uh-huh.
And I took a lot to wrap my mind around that. And calling social services in Orange County, New York, resulted, well, that's not neglect. That's just the way it is. They don't have a house, and we can't give them one. Well, that bothered me, and I think it stuck with me for a number of years. And then that was in 1981 or so. And then I didn't think all that much about it. I continued working as a school psychologist. I knew it was not good for any child, and to be living in such circumstances. And then I eventually went to seminary, midlife career change, and I was happy with that transition. Both congregations, eventually I was able to get them to support Family Promise, which is predominantly an East Coast program where churches open their doors and house families which are homeless for a week at a time. And week to week, they would transition from one church to another. And I got both of my congregations, one in New York and one in Pennsylvania, to join that program. And they provide services. There was a day program for young children, parents, in terms of helping them get jobs and what have you. And I felt good about that. And then when I moved out to the West Coast, I kind of just fell into it through attending Seattle Mennonite Church, and I discovered they have a whole homeless ministry for the Lake City area. And I just started helping out. And I've stayed with that. I guess you could say it's a calling at this point, or a form of a mission on my own part. Likewise, my involvement with Huntington's disease. That goes back to high school when my girlfriend shared with me her grandmother had just been diagnosed with Huntington's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that kept the interest alive. And so I'm involved in both communities. And occasionally they do intertwine, as it happened at God's Little Acre, which I think Elizabeth had just been sharing right before the show began. So I guess that's it in a nutshell, how I got involved with working with the homeless.
That's great. Elizabeth, you know, it's been a year and a half since we talked to you last, and you now have a new person that you're trying to help, and we thought maybe we could put out a flyer on Facebook to see if we can help you find his family. Can you talk about your new guy?
Yes, absolutely. A few months after Dale Ellingson died of Huntington's, Dr. Goodman called me and said there was another gentleman who also had been homeless, had no family, and he was in Dale's old room at the adult family home, and he had no family, so she said it might be too soon. She said, but if you would help and would like to meet him, she thought we might be a good fit. And I went directly from having coffee with Dr. Goodman and telling her I would think about it directly to the home and met James and realized that I couldn't just walk away from James. But his name is James Hamilton Sparks Jr. He was born in January in 1978. He says he was born in Erie, Pennsylvania. His mother died of Huntington's, and he comes from a family of two sisters and a brother. He doesn't have any idea where his family is. He has not heard from them or seen them in years, and he is not in a position at this point to give me very many facts about them. So any help at all would be appreciated. Anybody in the community that knows a family with by the last name of Sparks, I would imagine that they are in the HD community.
Mm-hmm. Does he not remember, or does he
would
not
you repeat
remember
that question?
His family, or he just does he not remember his family, or?
He does remember. He doesn't know where they are anymore, and he's confused by their. Doesn't remember their names. He says he has an older sister named Michelle, but he says that she changed her name to Sharon, and then has married, so he doesn't know her married name. And his dad, he doesn't share very many facts about his dad, other than. That his dad was in the military, and his dad divorced his mother when his mother started being symptomatic with the Huntington's.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that makes it so difficult to locate family when you don't really have a starting place. You have a very slight window peek into what you know his family. You might have names. Do you have other resources that can help find loved ones?
Dr. Goodman actually reached out to the caseworker who had done a genealogy report of some type, and they're trying to get that information for me so that I can work with someone. I'm not really sure. I'm sure there are people out there that know how to do this. I'm not one of them, so I'm starting with square one.
Actually, I might be able to help you, Elizabeth. One of my avocations is genealogy and family history.
Ooh.
So maybe you and
well,
I
how wonderful is this? That's fantastic.
Wow.
And the price,
thank
price
you,
is
Jim.
Right.
So we
we'll
came this far to get on a radio show.
Little tricks that genealogists use.
Thank you.
Well, so
that's what I needed to know. I'm going to hang up.
Oh, no, you don't.
I actually have somebody that is looking for their brother because her mother was homeless and she ended up having another child. And so this girl is an older sibling of the child. And being that the mother was sick, the child was adopted out. So the adopted family probably doesn't even know that there's Huntington's in the family. And she's searching for her brother, her sibling, you know. So I know this happens quite often. I've heard many other stories like this. How do we help these people? How do we, you know, find their loved ones? Because, you know, a lot of that information is protected, you know.
Right, I know that. Mm-hmm. That makes it very difficult because to open adopted records.
Yeah, how do you do that, you know?
Other than through courts. One possibility, and this is a long shot, but if you know where the family had lived, sometimes a letter to the editor of a local newspaper can open doors and windows,
mm-hmm.
describing the problem and the issue and why you are writing. Sometimes they'll run it, sometimes they won't, but it can't hurt to try.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
People in small towns especially have a way of knowing. They don't talk about it, but they may know more than they you'd think they would.
Mm-hmm.
And just a shot in the dark. Who knows? But I've done that trick several times with not for Huntington's disease, but in terms of genealogy, and I've hit pay dirt several times. Other times mm-hmm. I get nothing. So.
Mm-hmm. I think because we're talking about homelessness and people with Huntington's and the fact that it's probably more prevalent than we even know, mm-hmm. it all goes right back to education. It's making sure that people that are run the shelters, people that have anything to do with the homeless community, the soup kitchens, all of those, that they have an understanding. I'd never heard of Huntington's until I met Dale,
mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't have known what to look for. I would have thought he was just another drunk person on the street.
Right.
If
yeah.
someone hadn't educated me, and now when I see someone with those types of symptoms, you sort of know, but you know you don't know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. So true. And I know my partner Renette, when she saw Dale, she knew immediately it was Huntington's, just standing outside church.
Mm-hmm.
So, but most people don't know that and can't identify it. And even if you do know, there's occasionally one of the problems with people that are like into substance abuse and what have you, they can have some symptoms that mimic, like the chorea with Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what it is causing it. It's a neurological problem, but what?
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Part of genetic testing. But I agree that people in shelters, soup kitchens, whatever, need to be aware of Huntington's. But then comes the issue, even if you're aware of it, how do you get treatment for that person? Or how do you get them connected to relevant programs?
And that just goes back to the one thing that always is at the forefront of my mind is that people are always asking me, what organization am I affiliated with? And I always say, if everyone would just help one person, that would be enough. You don't have mm-hmm. to work for an organization. I work over 70 hours a week at my job, and I don't have time to volunteer at any one place for set hours, so many hours a week or anything like that, but I can do outreach to one person that I meet on the street. And it's just getting other people in the community to realize that that is what it takes. It doesn't take a great, big, huge effort on anybody's part. It takes doing one thing for one person.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Yeah, if everyone would just help one person.
Mm-hmm. And spreading that word.
The world would be a better place.
Well...
Gosh.
It sounds easy, but that's just, you know, getting that word out. I think people think that doing that you have to volunteer so many hours or you have to do a certain thing, but actually it isn't that big. It can be something as small as interacting with one person. And that's education too.
It's a big decision.
Dr. Goodman in the background, just going to say something, though. While you're interacting with one person, you also very knowledgeably and tactfully work with organizations to help this individual get the benefits that he can. So you do know, have learned how to negotiate various systems or organizations. You found me, for instance, mm-hmm. to help with his care. So it's Elizabeth is selling herself short a little bit.
Yeah, she is. She's got some secrets in there. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, the first place I met Elizabeth was
work.
In the hospital. where you were sitting with Dale.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that or not.
I don't.
That's where you and I met. He was in the hospital. He had been committed. At God's Little Acre, they set down a rule that he had to see some doctors. He needed treatment, and he was refusing to go. And he ended up getting committed, and at least for 2-3 days. And I went to visit him with Renette. And you were sitting right next to him.
Oh, and he ended
that
up...
That opened the door is a connection with you. And
Oh, wow.
And then it spun that I wanted to get Dr. Goodman involved. And so I contacted her, and eventually she got involved. Not through any reluctance on her part, but just in terms of trying to coordinate things.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, I found Dr. Goodman on the Dr. Goodman show, on this very show. I was looking things up on the computer for Huntington so I could learn more about it when I first met Dale, and I stumbled upon this show and listened to Dr. Goodman, and I reached out to her by email and told her the story of what was going on with Dale, and she agreed to see him.
Oh, that's okay. I didn't know that side.
Yeah, that was very, very fortuitous how that whole thing came about. I was listening to this very show.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
And I was working at the other end trying to get her to come visit him, either at GLA or at the assisted living facility.
Mm-hmm. Well, we corralled her.
Poor LaVon.
Yeah,
she didn't
have
a choice.
We all did. Well, okay, so let's talk about homelessness and a little bit more. How does this happen? Why do they end up on the street like this?
They being Huntington's patients or people in general?
Huntington's, people in general, but mostly Huntington's. I mean, we know that they're having issues with judgment and cognition and movement. But what happens? What happens to them when they end up this way?
Well, the few cases that I know, and I think LaVon actually could speak more directly to that question. Actually, LaVon, you want to do an answer first?
I think that people with Huntington's, it is more easily... accomplished that you become estranged from family.
Right, yeah.
So it really is, and you lose your job. You get divorced, and your family kind of can leave you. Or you can leave them. So there's a paranoia sometimes, and there's certainly distrust probably that is bilateral. Both the individual with Huntington's and the family can become distant and then estranged. And people lose their jobs, people lose their friends, and sometimes the recourse is it's easier just to be without those things sometimes. And I think that's one of the reasons people become homeless. I mean, there are many reasons, but they all kind of come together.
That's pretty close to what I would have said, too. One other thing I would throw in. Sometimes people with Huntington's have difficulty following rules or become rebellious. Well, if you rebel against the landlord, you know where that's going to get you.
Yeah. Also, in speaking with both James and with Dale, and specifically with Dale, his mother died of Huntington's, and he saw just some terrible things that he described. His mother was in a home where they actually tied her to the bed.
That's right.
And then his sister, who was fairly young, she had young kids that Dale lived with her. And her husband and the kids for many years while the kids were growing up. And his sister also died of Huntington's. And Dale, my understanding of it, is that he knew that he always said, I knew that I had Huntington's. I just knew that I did, even though he hadn't been tested. But after he saw his sister die and he lost track of her children, he just gave up, and he lost his job. He was working day labor jobs, and was able to keep an apartment with friends for quite some time, but he just started drinking and doing drugs, and it just spiraled out of control, and he felt that he was going to die anyway. He just wanted to get it over with. He knew what he was going to face, having seen his mother and his sister die in a most terrible way, and he knew that that was going to be his fate also. So why not drink and drug and, you know, and then he lost his apartment, and then he met me, and then he had to live a little bit more. but that's what he describes as just, I knew that the same thing was going to happen to me.
Is this like a form of mental illness?
I would think it's a form of self-preservation.
I would see it as such, or at least some of it, not totally. Not all homeless people are mentally ill,
mm-hmm.
but mental illness can contribute. And I think, I don't know, it's 1/3 or 2/3 of all people experiencing homelessness have mental illness. So the number is high.
Is it mental illness to give up hope and end up on the street like that because you've given up hope?
Well, it could certainly be depression.
Yeah.
Is depression a mental illness? It depends on the severity, I would say.
And I think that there can often be a paranoia.
Okay.
And I think both of the homeless individuals that we are talking about had a component of that, that no one was going to take care of them. They didn't, and they had difficulty being close to family. And part of that, you know, is it mental illness, the behavioral things, disturbances that happen in Huntington's? Well, I think you can call it, you know, that broad definition of mental illness means you're not able to live in whatever society it is comfortably, comfortable enough to interact with it. I guess I would define it sort of that way, and I believe that many people with Huntington's find that so. And they, and those particularly who don't have a support structure, will they have more behavioral problems? Yes, they will. Because they're not being helped to understand them. And if there aren't family supports, or if you don't avail yourself, the individual doesn't avail themselves of those supports for whatever reason, they are more likely to become more emotionally or behaviorally disturbed. And if there is not a family or, and family I'm defining broadly, to give support, then that person is more likely to become homeless.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's a disease, and it's a dis-ease of the body, of the mind. You're not at ease, and that when you feel that way and you act that way, it's very difficult to have a community come around you and support you. And if you don't have that, just exactly like Dr. Goodman just said, if you don't have that, then you can go in all kinds of different ways where you're not following any rules and you're getting into trouble constantly and you're rebelling against that. Dale went through quite a bit of that. And I think that once he felt that he could trust another person, which just happened to be me, he was able to settle down a little bit and to listen and be as reasonable as someone with that disease can be. But he was able to listen, and I could calm him down. But if there's nobody around that can calm you down, then, you know, you do sort of go crazy. And then you get treated like you're crazy.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, he did have extended family who were supportive. I only know of cousins. As Elizabeth, as we found out later, I was actually taking care of a couple family members who belonged to his family, but unbeknownst to me, because there was a different last name. And I do know that those families were very supportive of the Huntington's individuals within there, within that sibling, a sibling of his mother. So.
Mm-hmm. So, Elizabeth, did you have challenges in gaining the trust of, speaking of Dale, in the beginning? I mean, did you have trouble with that, or was he just needing so much help he didn't fight it?
Oh, he fought it.
Sometimes they fight it,
he
right?
He fought it, yes.
Oh.
Right from the beginning, and what I think, you know, from the very first night that I saw him, and I stopped and talked to him, and from then on, I stopped every single day and talked to him and brought him food, and sometimes he would be mean, and sometimes he would be angry, and sometimes he would be just terrible. And I would just say, okay, well, you can act that way, but I'm still going to come back, but I'm leaving right now, and I would leave. But I always came back. And after 4 years of that, he figured I wasn't going to go away.
Oh my goodness!
But it wasn't easy, and there were many, many times when I walked away and thought, why am I doing this? Why would I even come back? But I always knew that it wasn't, you know, I just thought, well, what would I do if I was in that place? How would I feel? And I always came back, and he was always contrite, and he was always happy to see me until the next time.
I think what Elizabeth demonstrated is something that people who work with individuals who are experiencing homelessness, is what they really need is a companion, somebody that will walk the journey with them. And I think Elizabeth did that with Dale and just was there for him. And that's what many people need, I think.
And compassion.
A loving presence.
With a little bit of rules thrown in there.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right, yes, Elizabeth. But
a lot of rules.
Yes, but what Elizabeth does so wisely is she knows when to step back.
Yeah.
And to have things cool down. How often is that important in all of our lives? Not to make too many rules at the wrong time.
Yeah. True.
And Elizabeth knows how to negotiate that better than anybody I've met.
She has discernment.
and I guess it was a negotiation, because we were always negotiating what was acceptable and what was not. And, you know, boundaries. I had to set boundaries. You know, what can I do and what do I not want to do? But I gave him a pretty wide berth.
Mm-hmm. So, hey, Jim, how can we, within our own communities, help with the homeless situation? How do we plug in? Where do we start?
It depends what's available to start with, in all honesty.
Yeah.
I know where I was before, on the East Coast, it was not very much around. And one individual I don't think could do much, unless you were an individual like Elizabeth. But unfortunately, there aren't too many folks like her, including myself. I needed to have an organization that was already going, or that existed, that I could plug my church in and my congregation in, as well as other churches in the geographical locale, to set up a program. And that, mind you, is basically devoted only to families. What I'm working with now is predominantly not families, but individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And then to me, it would be most of my exposure now at this point is it's a half-day program, a drop-in center for people experiencing homelessness that allows them to fix some meals with food that's either donated or that they bring themselves, that provides laundry facilities and shower facilities, plus minimal storage facilities for their possessions. And, I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult if you had one or two congregations around or a group of people interested in setting up something like that.
So you have to get a specific type of building where there's multiple...
Well, we have had, in the 2 or 3 years that I've worked in this program, they've had three different settings. First, they had a small, very small house that they used for that. And then it moved, since they were tearing down that house for building a much larger building, we moved to the foyer of a church, which was crowded and cramped, but it did work. People would come for their coffee. Everything was done without cost, by the way. The coffee was free. The food was free and what have you. The laundromat was free. There was a washer and a dryer, and there was a shower. And that was a very small space. That now we have a much larger space, concrete floors, tall ceilings, state-of-the-art lighting. I can't believe it. LED, dimmable, turn
controls
on and off. But it's a lot more spacious, a lot noisier, too, because they didn't do good sound baffling. But, I mean, you don't need a specific type of facility. What you do need, quite possibly, depending upon the city, is checking the zoning and not being out of compliance with that. Although if it's a church, that tends to give you more leeway. And a group of people that are concerned about homelessness and want to be a friend. And also what's tricky, or at least from my point of view, is you do not want to set it up to proselytize. You don't want to convert people to your own way of thinking.
Right.
You're there for them and nothing
right.
but that. If you
right.
contaminate what you're doing with other things, it's just going to not. It's not going to be very successful, I don't think.
I'd like to add to that is that I agree with Jim. I think that for most people, finding either an organization that is already doing it, or you know, if you start something on your own, doing exactly what Jim is saying is how they're set up. You have to meet people where they are. I think you also have to have a good understanding of trauma-informed care so that you're coming to people knowing that they are just human people that are traumatized by something and are reacting to that in many cases. But I also think that there's nothing extraordinary about what I did with Dale or what I'm doing with James. And I want to be very clear for anyone that is listening, that you can make a difference. You can do something just yourself without having to go to any great extent. You don't have to join a group. You don't have to start up anything. You can just start out by talking to someone that you see on a regular basis if you feel safe doing that. Just start by talking to people and find out who they are and what their story is and what do they need right now. Sometimes they just need a hello. They want to be treated like people, like humans. They want someone to look them in the eye and say, do you need a pair of socks? Can I get you something to drink? It's cold out. Do you need some gloves? But, you know, it can be something so simple and doing it regularly. Just stop by every you go by a certain spot every Monday and you see a person there every Monday, stop every Monday. And then the next time you come by, say, hey, I said I was going to bring you some socks. Here's a pair of socks or anything. And anyone can do that. You do not
so
have
true.
To do anything extraordinary to do that.
And you don't even have to bring socks. What you can do is just say, hi, how are you?
Yep.
Yeah.
Just making that eye contact.
A kind word.
And treating them as a human being. And so often in society, at least the places that I've been, you don't want to make contact. You try to avoid the eye contact. You don't talk to a stranger. Well, this is going just the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking to them and see what happens.
Why do you suppose people are so afraid to do that?
Because it might grow. You might start caring about the person. They might ask you for a pair of socks. I say that laughingly, but it's true. And you want to defend yourself from any possibility of upsetting whatever you're doing. Or you don't want to get involved.
There are some people that don't want to, you know, I have friends that will support me by giving me money to do things to help other people. And I always take their money and say thank you, because I know that they have money, they want to do something, but, you know, they don't want to get near a homeless person. They don't want to touch one. They don't want to see it up close, but they want to help. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. Some people can help that way. Some people can help by being out there doing, and you just have to know what kind of person you are and
right.
do whatever it
right.
is that you can do.
And
if
and
it's
also
from far away, do it.
And if you do get close, you also have to be able to say no and set limits or boundaries, as Elizabeth said
mm-hmm.
before. Because you will be asked at times to do something inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sorry, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And some people have real trouble saying no. And you have to be able to say no, too.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be
yeah.
able to say yes, and you have to be able to say no.
I guess my question is, how do we instill that will to care, you know, in other people?
I don't think you can instill it, but I think that you can reach out and find the people that have it. Some people do
yeah.
and some people don't, and some people have the ability to give money, some people have the ability to give time, and some people have the ability to give heart.
The only way I know to instill it is through role modeling.
Yeah.
Doing it yourself. And maybe if you're the parent with very young children, start at a very early age helping them learn to give.
Mm-hmm.
Of themselves and financially, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And even that's not guaranteed. I mean, I don't know
mm-hmm.
how I became the way I am. Some of it, I think, was through parenting, but others of it was through life experiences and just thinking, what makes sense? What is the type of person that I want to become or be?
I always say I was born that way. I didn't have a choice.
That may be true, but I like to think I had a little bit of say.
And then they broke the mold.
But I think it's just getting the word out and drawing people to you of whatever it is that you need, that you're looking for, and by just finding those people, educating, putting the word out so that people that are interested can step in. There are a lot of people that want to do something and they just don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Outreach.
So advocacy, awareness, outreach, innovative ways to go out there and meet these people. Show
so
that
again.
You care. You know?
A word on awareness. You know, people, I don't think there are very many people who aren't aware of the homeless.
True.
Right.
What you want to do is create awareness, create empathy for the individual who is homeless. And when Jim said to mentor, show with the interaction with this real homeless person, this person who is homeless, you know, we shouldn't describe the person as, you know, this is the adjective, you know, you're a homeless person or you're a Huntington's person. Instead, you are a person who is homeless. You are a person who has Huntington's. So it's not awareness, but it is awareness of how one can help, being visible, helping, I think. You know, Elizabeth kind of does this invisibly, but a show like this makes her more visible.
Mm-hmm.
And what she does has, with one person at a time, has major impact. And people, each of us need to see and then become that one individual who is concerned about the other individual with whatever,
mm-hmm.
whether it's homelessness or Huntington's. So it's not just creating an awareness. We know, you know, everyone's aware of homelessness. That isn't the problem. The problem is the awareness of individuals who help other individuals with that homeless problem situation.
Right. Looks like we have a caller here. Let me check. Hi, caller on 636. Do you have a question? Welcome to the show.
Hi, Melissa. It's Carla. I'm in Missouri.
Hi, Carla. Thanks for calling in, Carla. Do you have a question for our guest?
I usually have to, you know, run and jump and get in here at the last minute because, you know, my other obligations. But I do. I did make a comment that this topic really hits home for me because my ex-husband, the father of my children, you know, went missing and ended up dying in a nursing home in Oregon. And it was only through me searching for him and found his obituary and contacted the funeral home who, you know, said, we had no idea that he even had any family at all. And I thought, you know, this man was a veteran, and they certainly had his Social Security number, and he has two kids that, you know, are... In other words, I'm wondering how in the world someone could have not investigated to try to find his, at least his children.
I'm sorry that you went through that. Yeah, first of all, this is Elizabeth. That's a terrible way to find out what you found out. It is from... I'm saying from my viewpoint of trying to find family for James, it is not that easy to find people. Jim has some more information about that, but as just being a person that is trying to do that without knowing very much about it, it's hard. And if he was in a home, you said?
Yeah, the funeral home gentleman, who was just stunned when I called and after I read the obituary, and I said, you know, I am, this is the father of my children, and he's been missing for, you know, decades. And I said, you know, he was just stunned. He said, oh, my gosh. And then he told me what nursing home he was at, and after that point, because I was not his wife, then they wouldn't talk to me, but they did. We did get his remains back to be able to, you know, bury him through because his mother was still alive. But my thought was, as a veteran, and he had been hospitalized throughout the years, that from what I understand, that just through his Social Security number alone, that there would have been some way to have found at least his children, you know.
The problem is if he doesn't not want that known, I'm not sure if anybody can do anything to find
him. Oh, you know, I didn't really think of it that way.
I don't know. This is just a question I have. I know Social Security numbers sometimes are helpful after the person dies. But before then, I don't know if you can use that number to track down. Now, VA possibly could have, but I don't know if he was involved with the Veterans Administration. And if he could initiate having them look for you or his children, but I don't know if they can take that on themselves without that person's consent.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what condition. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying that it would take somebody wanting to help that person do this, especially if he was ill. He might not have been able to do it on his own, and somebody would have had to be advocating for him to look.
Yeah, but if he didn't want to, that stops everything, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, and I have no idea how he ended up at that nursing home, but I do know that he had a pretty, from what his mother could piece together, a pretty rough journey of homelessness and hospitalizations and,
Was the Huntington's
issues.
Positive as well?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
And so when I asked the gentleman at the funeral home, I said, what was the cause of death? Because when he went missing, it was not known about the Huntington's, at least as far as I knew.
Right.
It wasn't known. And I said, what was the cause of death? And he said, aspiration, pneumonia. And I said, my ex-husband had Huntington's disease. Is that anywhere on there? And they said, he said, there was an unspecified movement disorder listed. So, a lot of these folks just go. And I think that is, a lot of the reason, too, that we don't have, I don't think, correct statistics.
Surely.
Because
we agree.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, thank you all for
thanks for calling
in. This is a
again,
very
apologies and sorrow for what you experienced.
Yeah, so sorry.
Thank you so much for
calling in.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks
thank
for calling.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Sounds like, we lost her. I think she clicked off. Okay.
Yeah, she did.
Is it? Yeah, okay. One of the comments in the chat room from Mary, she says, fear keeps a lot of people from helping the homeless.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
I think that's a true statement, too.
Fear of the unknown, fear of being involved.
Everybody's afraid that you have to let your compassion override your fear.
Yeah. Getting back to the a question that I think Melissa had asked in terms of what can people do, if you're not like Elizabeth and willing to or have the opportunity to work with an individual on one-on-one, most communities, or at least in my experience, many communities have food banks, are food pantries, are clothing pantries. Often they're run by local churches or volunteer organizations. That might be a place where you could start inquiring, is there any other programs for people experiencing homelessness, and become involved that way. If this is something you're really interested in pursuing. I know in the community I live, which is in Arlington, Washington, the churches have, again, not family promise, but another type of, during the winter months, they have shelter they set up where a church will host it, I think, for a week at a time. At night, people could come and spend the night there. They also have a food pantry that rotates among people. But contacting any one person in that link will get you involved with other people dealing with the problem locally as best they can. And I'm sure they will welcome volunteers. And that might be one place to start. And over time, you might want to grow and expand in your involvement, if what have you. But start small. I'd ask a local clergyman or clergywoman.
Yes.
There's a way of...
Good idea.
Go ahead.
I would also suggest for people to pick something that they love to do. If you like to sew, if you like fashion, if you like to cook, whatever it is that you enjoy doing, you can find someone doing that exact same thing for people that might need it. Some, whether it's a closet where they're providing clothing for people that are going back to work, maybe that have been experiencing homelessness and maybe now they have housing, or whether it's a kitchen where you can help cook a meal. If you like to work with children, there are places that have where the children go of when they're experiencing homelessness also. If you liked whatever it is that you like to do, chances are you're going to find an organization that is doing something for people experiencing homelessness.
So true.
Good points. Thank you so much. Did we leave anything out? Dr. Goodman, do you want to say a few words on wrapping this up?
Well, I think the Elizabeth and the Rev have really said it better than I could. They have been active in this arena for a number of years and know a great deal about it. I only know about it from my my physician kind of experience with homeless individuals. So I would listen to the other two.
Can I say one last thing? We didn't get into this, although we talked about it ahead of time, and that is there's a movement afoot, which to me makes a lot of sense. It was started by Sam, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, Simbaris, who's a psychologist in New York State, and other states are starting to pick up in it, our cities as well, where for the longest time it's been felt that, well, if you do X, Y, and Z, you can get a housing voucher for housing, and that the homeless people have to jump through a bunch of hoops first to get the housing. The thought is flipping that whole scenario upside down is first provide the housing to people, free. Provide support, counseling, and then other things fall into place, seemingly. And apparently that has had some success. It has a success ratio of 85% of people staying in housing. And once they have housing and are secure in that aspect, some of the substance abuse drops down. They become more positive in their involvement in the community and what have you. It's not a cure-all for all cases of homelessness, and it doesn't remarkably transform the individual, but it does seemingly help and keep people from consuming many more services that they no longer need to consume once they have their own home or an apartment. It doesn't have to be a house. And that's something I think people need to look up and investigate more if you're concerned about homelessness and what is the best way to treat it.
Yeah, I actually saw that article on your Facebook page, Jim. It's called Meet the Outsider Who Accidentally Solved Chronic Homelessness or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And it's about this Sam Timberis.
And he's also spoken on TED, I believe. He's been one of the lecturers on TED. And there's a fair amount of publicity about this program and his thinking. And also, I mean, Utah's doing that. I think Phoenix did something very similar. And so far the results have been positive. Who would have thought?
Gosh.
So,
save some people too, right?
Pardon?
Might save some people too, right?
True. Oh, yeah. Very much so. But again, it probably will not solve everything. I know there's some people that even given housing can't follow the minimal rules that exist, and they end up losing it.
We have a comment in our chat room. James says, get to know what services are available in your community and share this with everyone. Thank you, James.
Very much so.
Great show, you guys. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to do a few announcements and then we'll wrap this up. You guys can hang with me.
Sure.
Wanted to let everybody know about Katie Jackson, our vice president. She is doing the first JHD Kids Walk in Sacramento at McKinley Park on June 13. Health for HD International's book titled Life Interrupted is going to be published very soon. It's being formatted as we speak. It's a wonderful book with 13 writers. All of these writers are either caregivers or have HD or have very close ties to Huntington's. And It's just so well written. I'm so proud of it, and I can't wait for it to be published and sent out. Helping for HD Affordability, Shop and Resource Center is opening next month, Central Coast, California. This is a thrift store model, somewhat modeled after the American Cancer Society Discovery Shops secondhand store. We'll also have equipment for HD families as well, you know, shower chairs, wheelchairs, things like that, clothing, household items, that kind of thing that will be able to afford some of our families that need help, and also a resource center. We'll have lots of information about community resources, and we'll have clinical trial information there. We'll be able to help our HD families find the proper care and services that are out there. They just don't know about them yet. Then our second annual symposium is August 22nd at Riverside in Mission Inn at Riverside. Those are some events coming up. We're also going to be attending the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police. We're not sure yet if we will be presenting there at a workshop. We're waiting to hear. But we are definitely interested in continuing to educate our first responders, law enforcement, EMTs, that kind of thing about Huntington's. And we definitely want to have a homeless outreach. Our social services director, Katrina Hamill, has a huge heart for that. Her mother was homeless, and she found her mother on the street and brought her home to care for her. She's since passed, but she is another Elizabeth. I can't wait to see what she comes up with. So we're excited about that. But I just want to thank you all again, Rev Jim, Elizabeth, Dr. Goodman. You are so awesome. I love you. And this concludes our show tonight, and we'll talk to you next week. Don't forget to tell all your colleagues, family, and friends about Help for HD Radio. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Y'all have a good night. Thank you. Put you guys in the chat room.